What year was that?
Well, I sort of grew up as a young teenager in the 60s.
Yeah.
And what made an impression on me, the same as a lot of kids in that time, was the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, we used to go to matinees Saturday afternoon and watch Fabian and Elvis and all those clean-cut looking guys with not a hair out of place and their teeth perfect and that sort of thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not an image that you could really attain to unless you looked exactly like one of those guys, and there wasn't that many guys around that looked like Fabian or Elvis.
And this is up in Newcastle, isn't it?
Well, no, I was living in Queensland. I'm Welsh originally.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Wales and come out here when I was five years old. And the family settled in North Queensland, near Townsville originally, and then grew up, went to school in Charters Towers.
So there wouldn't have been any music scene in Towers.
Well, no, there wasn't a Slim Dusty, and that was about it. Slim Dusty and Chad Morgan, you know, and I hated that. I really hated the Australian country scene. You know, I didn't hate the American country scene so much. Marty Robbins and Johnny Horton and those sort of country type singers from America, I really liked their music and their songs and stuff like that.
Mm.
I liked the message, but I mean, Slim really sing about his flies and the dust, and I was living there.
Yeah.
I hated it. So when Slim come out singing about, you know, rounding up the cattle, he's like, I just wanted to be out of there because I come from Wales, which is all beautiful. I come from the dairy district in South Wales and from Carnarvon. Not Carnarvon, that's up north. And it was all beautiful, and the beaches we used to go to, all the beautiful beaches in South Wales. That's why Cook named the east coast of Australia New South Wales, because all the beaches.
Mm-hmm.
Because South Wales has got the best beaches in Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up with beaches and all the beautiful countryside. When we first came to Townsville, they had the beautiful beaches there, and you know, I loved Townsville. It was great, you know. And then when the family moved west over the Great Dividing Range, which was only 84 miles away, it was a rain shadow. It was just brown, man. Everything was just brown, dry, horrid, and everything was ugly. I mean, all the houses are on sort of stilts and fibro houses, and it was hell.
So inevitably you reacted against it.
Well, the home was always full of music, because being Welsh, my earliest memories of back home is singing. We all grew up singing. You know, that's the way it is. If anybody's been to Wales, you know the culture of the place. And my father was a singer. He used to sing at the concerts, the local Charters Towers concerts. And I sang all through school, school concerts and choirs and things, and we always had music at home. So I grew up with my father's music, which was by Johnny Mathis and Nat King Cole, Harry Belafonte, and the Platters, that sort of stuff. So we always had music at home, but it wasn't rock and roll. Dad was not into Elvis.
Mm.
Even though Elvis was sort of around, you know, he just wasn't into Elvis or that sort of thing. So he had one record of Elvis's, one single.
Mm.
And when he wasn't around, we used to play both sides to death, you know. And he also had one record, that's right, of Little Richard. I loved Little Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And but I only used to play it when Dad wasn't around. And so really, I guess the Beatles sort of hit when I was in my early teens, and that just changed everything, because they looked like ordinary guys. They looked like all of us, and they had long hair, you know. And then the Stones came out and they were ugly. So it was like, they were all ugly, half of assholes. So it was like, you know, mate, if I can be famous and all that sort of stuff, we hope for everybody, you know. And I think that's one of the things that happened with the 60s, was the sound was it was a revolutionary sound. It wasn't so much that they hated everybody else and all that. It was just a new way of life, new way of thinking. That's what the music said.
Mm.
And freedom, really, freedom was really freedom of expression, the clothes, the hair. And the generation, my father's generation, of course, had just come from a war, Second World War, and I guess through all the uncertainties of the war, after the war, I guess they wanted to hang on to things and play it safe. That's right. Get a job, stay your job all your life, and all that kind of stuff. You know, I couldn't sort of get into all that sort of stuff. And the music, it just meant freedom of thought, freedom of expression. And so, living in Charles Towers was very restricting, and everybody looked the same, and everybody had the same attitude, and everybody knew everybody else, and that kind of stuff, and it was just really stifling for me. And it was the same with kids all over America, all over the world, really, all over Australia. And so consequently, I left home when I was 16. We fought with Dad about my hair being long and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Were you playing by then?
No, I wasn't playing anywhere at that time. I was only 16 years old, so I packed up my bags and went down to Sydney, which is a big move at 16.
Yeah. You know. So what did you find?
I sort of headed for the cross, I guess, went to the cross, and that was like the Haight-Ashbury of Australia.
Mm-hmm. And this is when?
This is about 60, about 70, I suppose. 69. Mm-hmm. Oh, 68, I guess, yeah. And King's Cross was Haight-Ashbury, Australia's Haight-Ashbury. Mm-hmm. All the hippies and were living at the Cross. That was where everyone was that had long hair and that sort of stuff. Our element fountain was there, and they hadn't cemented over the joint. And that's it was a big little park there. Mm-hmm. Right? I used to sit on there and we used to play the guitars and all the tourists would come and take photos of you and all that sort of stuff. It was the place to be, you know. And and I got to meet a lot of musos. And I was only there for a short while. Then I went back to Charters Towers for a while when I was 17. And I used to sing all the time. I used to sing around town. Everywhere I went, I'd be singing at the top of my voice. I guess the Welsh in there, you can't really help it.
Yeah.
And I'd put on a jukebox, and I'd sing all the songs loud. So you couldn't hear the fucking jukebox. It'd just be me singing. And there was a little band in town who were playing the 60s music. But there was another band in town, but they were playing all some dusty stuff and all the old music. Now, they had all the gigs in town. But there was another band started up. And I remember Laurie Vera, he was the guy that had the band. He met me one night, and I'd been down the Big Smoke too, but I'd been to Sydney,
yeah,
right, and sort of come back. So it was like, I've been down there and seen the music scene down here and stuff. And
you're the local celebrity.
Yeah, it was like, you know, you've been to Sydney, you know. And I said, yeah, my hair was longer than everybody else's, so I was, you know, cooler than everybody else. There wasn't much long hair in town. There was only about half a dozen of us.
Mm.
But he said, you know, Dave, you know, I've got the band. I said, yeah. He said, you know, you sing all the bloody time. He said, why don't you join the band? No, he said, no, first of all, that's right. He said, I'm playing tonight, later on, come and see the band. That's right. This is what happened. He said, I'm playing tonight. He said, come and see the band and tell me honestly what you think of it. Because I was the local guru into music. I'd been to Sydney and that sort of stuff, made all the Beatle records. And so I sort of went, yeah, okay. I was only 17 at the time, but like, yeah, they want my opinion. So I went along. I heard Laurie and the boys, and they weren't bad. But they didn't have a singer. Nobody could sing in the band. And so after the gig, Laurie sort of came up and said, you know, well, what do you think of the band? Honestly, Dave. And I hate it when people ask you that, because if you tell the truth, they hate you anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had nothing to lose. So I just sort of said, well, look, I think the band's pretty good, you know. I said, but, you know, you need a singer. Singing's not very good. And he said, that's what I want to talk to you about. I said, I had no inkling. I had no idea. He said, do you want to join the band? Singer. And I got such a shock. It was something that I hadn't even thought about, really. Even though I'd sung every single of my life, it was like, I said no. I said, oh, no, decline sort of thing, you know. And then during the next week, I was thinking about it. I thought, well, why the hell not? I mean, I look like like I should be in a band, and I sing all the time, and I can sing better than those guys.
Mm.
So I saw Laurie a week later, and I was going to go up to him and ask him whether or not that opening was still there, and if it was, I'd ask if I would join.
Mm.
But before I could say that, he said, "Well, why are you going to join?" He said straight away, and I went, "Yeah." And so we started my first band in Chowders Towers, playing the pubs, even though I was too young to drink or anything like that.
Mm.
That was my first band in Chowders Towers, playing around. And
what were you doing, 60s covers?
Or? Yeah, 60s covers. You know, Bee Gees, Beatles, Rolling Stones, Kinks, Frogs, all that sort of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And did that for about a year and a half or so. And I suppose it's a drunk talk, but a lot of people would come and say, you know, you're great, Dave, you're great, you're really fantastic, you're as good as anything around, all this sort of stuff, you get all that, you know, from everybody, and I sort of half believed it, so, and I hated Chalice Towers, I'm going back to Sydney, I've had this, I'm going back there forever, I'm not going back to live in this place, and I asked the other boys, so let's go down to Sydney and make the big time, you know, let's just go down there and be famous, you know.
Mm.
And they wouldn't go because they had jobs in a lot of public service, bank, and all that sort of stuff. And
they had the security.
That's right, and they couldn't go. You know, and I've always been the rebel sort of thing, leaving home at 16 in the first place. So I went down to Sydney, and just got the Sydney Morning Herald, and looked in the paper, and looked for people that wanted singers. You know. And just went out and answered an ad. I was the only singer to turn up that day, I remember. And I got a job, so.
And what was that with?
Oh, that was with a band called, we ended up calling it Django, after Django Reinhardt.
Mm-hmm.
But we played a few gigs around the place and, bands sort of broke up, as a lot of bands do. But I was pretty wrapped coming down from Chowders Towers and answering the ad and getting a job in a Sydney band. It was like pretty big news. It meant I was actually accepted by the Sydney musos,
mm-hmm.
even though there was only half a dozen of them, but there were Sydney musos, and they said, yes, I had the job. I said I was only a singer to turn up, but it's just true. I got the job and started singing around Sydney at that time, the band broke.
So yeah. What's next?
What's next?
Yeah.
Well, I got another band together with some musos that I met, you know, around the cross and that. And can't remember the name of that band. It was just another little band. We played a few more gigs around the place. But where we played, people really liked the band.
Is this still all covers?
Yeah, it was covers, but it was heavier music now. With Django, the other guys were into sort of heavier music, like, what's that band that, Grand Funk Railroad. So it was heavier type of music, and very early Free. And Iron Butterfly, right? So I was starting to get into the heavier type of music, and they were still all covers, and they were still sort of the popular, fairly popular music that was happening at that time. And then I moved to Bondi, and I used to drink at a place called The Cask, a little wine bar in Bondi Road. I think it's an Indian restaurant there. It's a tiny little place. And I got in with the musos there, and they were blues musos. I didn't know anything about blues. Blues was something that, you know, were on 78s or something, you know, like blues was. And they started talking to me about rock and roll, the roots of rock and roll, where it came from, blues and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I played all these blues, old Blue Muddy Waters, Lead Belly, and all that sort of stuff, you know. And I got into the blues because it gave me an expression, because I didn't have to learn any lyrics. I could just get out there half pissed with the rest of the boys, and they just get up and do a slow blues in A, or a fast blues in E, or G, or whatever it was, and they left me to make up the sing what I like, which is great, because I've always been good at just making up lyrics on the spot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it gave me a freedom of expression of being able to sort of make up lyrics, which helped me later on in songwriting, I guess, and also I didn't have to stick to any melody, which meant that as a singer and as a muso too, you can sort of make up the melody as long as within the...
So it's the beginning of the songwriting.
That's right, and freedom of expression, and I didn't have to keep to a melody. I mean, I could get out there and make something happen, and people really love that.
Mm.
And I sort of felt I was onto something, and the people really, really got into it. There's a band called Knob, N-O-B, and the Cask, there's a young singer, chick singer, just started off singing the same as me, called Renee Gay. She started off there. She had a band called Renee Gay and Son, like Richard Clapton, all those guys. We were all sort of hanging around Bondi, and we all used to go there, and you know, we used to get paid $5 a night or something. We'd drink $10 worth a night, so it was one of those things, you know. But she used to jam with us, and I used to jam with her. And there was other blues musicians. We used to jam together and that sort of thing. So it was a real little scene here in Bondi, blues scene, and I really liked that. But I sort of realised the blues. The blues aren't going to do anything for me. You know, I'm not going to sort of make records or get anywhere doing the blues. So I answered an ad in the paper looking for a singer, but it sounded like they were a pretty top band. They were pretty shifty about the ad. They're going like, you know, we won't tell you who the band is, but top band, all kind of stuff. And so I just rang up and spoke to somebody there who was purporting to be their manager or whatever, and told them, you know, that I was a pretty good singer and that kind of stuff, and I asked them what they were into. They were into sort of Free and all that kind of stuff. They were saying all the right bands that I really liked, like Free and The Who, Rod Stewart, Small Faces, that sort of stuff, which I sort of liked. And anyway, I gained an audition and turned up, well, Palm Beach way up there, Monavar. And it was the guys from a band called Velvet Underground, which was the Australian Velvet Underground.
Mm.
And that was pretty exciting because I knew of the band. I'd never seen them, but I knew of them, and they were one of the top bands in Sydney that hadn't recorded, but they were a name. If somebody said, "Oh, they'd go, oh yes," so I was pretty excited, and I think we auditioned a couple of Free numbers or something, Paul Rogers, and they said, "Oh yeah, well, you know, all sort of stuff." And I rang back a couple of days later, and they said, "Yeah, you got the job." So I was pretty excited about that, and so I joined them. And when I was out there, Monavale, it was really near the end of that band. They'd been around for a while. They had another singer called Jeff Phillipson, I think, and a few other guys in the band, and they used to also back Ted Mowry, right? So we'd go on, and then Ted would go on after us, and the band would play with him, and I'd hang back. So they knew Ted pretty well, and they used to talk about this other guy that they used to have in the band, a little fellow they called him. And those boys weren't tall anyway, they're only 5'7" or something, you know.
Yeah,
and the bass player we had at the time, I can't remember, Mick, his name was Mick something like that. He was about 5'4". I mean, he's pretty small, you know. And they kept talking about the little fellow. I said, how little is this bloke then, you know? And they said, real little. Malcolm Young. And they said, he's a brother of George Young from Easy Beats. And of course, Easy Beats were one of my idols, you know. Anybody that grew up in the 60s, when you talk about Trogs or Rolling Stones, I mean, you've got to talk about the Easy Beats in the same breath. Mm. They were that good.
Mm.
So, but I didn't, you know, I said, oh yeah, it was just like, you know, trivia, like Malcolm Young, the little fella used to be with the band, he was in Hungary or something. And so we played for not a long time, and eventually they said, oh look, you know, we're going to join Ted. Herman Les said that they're joining Ted permanently.
Mm-hmm.
They became TMG, and no hard feelings, it's just that Ted had the records out. and we were still trying to get a record or whatever, but it made sense that they joined him, and okay, I didn't have a band.
Mm.
So... Now, just to stop this for a second.
Yeah.
Now, the band sort of broke up, and it wasn't long. I was living in Bondi, of course, as I was saying, and it wasn't long after that. I think it was a Sunday afternoon or something. There was a knock on the door, and I opened it up, and there was this tiny little guy, about 5 foot tall, with really long, sort of brown wavy hair and green teeth. And this other guy who's a really tall bloke, big, sort of fat guy, big bloke, with long brown hair too. And the little guy introduced himself to me as Angus Young. And he'd heard of me through connections and Velvet Underground, that sort of stuff, and knew that I didn't ever have a band. I mean, you'd have to put this in the book, really, because this is really for the other story, so I won't worry about that. How AC/DC happened, right? So you just don't worry about that part of it, because that comes into a reason for other stuff. I'll talk to you later, okay? So really, what happened after Velvet Underground split up, and they joined Ted and became Ted Murray Gang, I was without a band, and I looked in the paper again, because in those days, the Sydney Morning Herald used to have a lot of band stuff in there. Mm. It doesn't anymore.
Mm.
But all, in the casual work available, it was just full of drummers wanted. And then they've got all these free magazines and stuff around the place. People put their ads in there.
Yes.
So I looked in the Sydney Morning Herald again a bit later on, and there was a, you know, singer wanted, and it looked interesting. And I rang up, and the guy on the end of the phone sort of asked me who I was, and I said, Dave Evans. And he says, oh, Dave. He said, it's Malcolm Young. I went, oh, Malcolm. He said, oh, you just finished up with the boys from Velvet Underground. And I said, yes, I used to play with them. He said, that's right. So he knew of me, and I knew of him. We both played with Velvet Underground.
Mm.
So what he said was, look, you know, come over and have a blow, because he's putting a band together. So I lobbed over in Newtown, and Malcolm was there. I hadn't met him before. I met him, and Colin Burgess from the Masters Apprentices was on drugs. Another guy called Larry, I don't know his last name now, Larry Van, rather. I think his name's in the PD of Rock and Roll or whatever, somewhere. But so he was on bass. And so we had a blow, and it sounded really good, and I was pretty impressed. It was Colin Burgess from the Masters Apprentices sitting there, you know, looking like a pop star, and Malcolm was a really good player, and Larry was a good bass player, and it was like shit. So I got him sort of, you know, do what I did, and And so they went, yeah, have we got a band or have we got a band? And they were happy with me, and I was happy with them, so we formed the band. We said, we've got a band. We didn't have a name or anything, but we said, yeah, we've got a band? We have a band. Mm-hmm. So a couple of weeks later, Angus Young had a band, which relates to what I was saying before, but I'll leave that till later. It's when we're doing the other thing. But Angus Young had a band, and Malcolm said, oh, Angus' band, Kentucky, has broken up. Couldn't get a singer. Do you mind a few auditions for us? Because we already said we were a band, you know? Mm-hmm. And then a couple of weeks later, Angus Young arrived, you know, and we had a blow, you know. Sounded good, you know, played well. And so we said, yeah, okay, you're in too. So then there were five of us, and so we started, you know, we kept rehearsing, and we're doing sort of 12-bar stuff, 12-bar rock and roll, sort of 12-bar stuff that the Stones had done, and a couple of sort of Bad Company, free Bad Company sort of numbers, and it was quite a few different rock and roll, because with the 12-bar rock and roll, what was good about the boys, the two guys could play. I mean, Malcolm was a better player than Angus, or, well, I suppose it was debatable, they were both damn good. And with the 12-bar rock and roll, they used to have duels together, and they were that bloody good. But it was brilliant to watch, you know, which they don't do anymore, of course, because they've got a set thing. But back in those days, Malcolm would get up and go, "Fucking have that," and he'd go, "Shit." And then Angus would come in and go, "Fucking have that." Mm. And they were they're both competitive by nature and competitive with each other. Mm. That they'd be trying to blow each other off the fucking stage, and they meant it. Mm. They really meant it. So it blew people away, you know, because Angus was so young. We were all really young, you know, we were all pretty much kids. So, okay, we had a band, and but we didn't have a name. And we tossed around a few sort of names and stuff, and we said, okay, we'll all go away and think of a name and come back the next rehearsal and see, you know, what the best one was, kind of thing, and if we agree on something. And when we got together, Angus and Malcolm, I can't remember one of them, said, oh, our sister's come up with a really good name, ACDC. ACDC, which is not power plug ACDC, could mean sort of sexual ACDC plug or power, that kind of stuff. And I thought, gee, that runs off the bloody tongue pretty well too. ACDC is like an easy name to sort of say, and it's an easy one to remember. And there wasn't any other band around that sort of had a similar type sounding name. And, you know, called itself those. Anything, but there's a lot of bands with, you know, but AC/DC, there was no sort of equivalent, like you got UB40 these days or you know, all that sort of stuff. So AC/DC was a good one. So we went, yeah, cool, we'll call it that.
That was the little sister.
That was the biggest sister. Yeah. Big sister. She's grown up sister. And anyway, this is getting close to Christmas, remember, and there was a guy called, no, this was 73, about November 73, December 73 now, and there was a guy, Checkers used to be one of the main gigs in Sydney, and there was a guy that was interested in us, because he used to know the Easy Beats and knew, I think knew Colin's older brother Denny, used to be with the Throb or something. Yeah, and Alan Kissick used to manage them for a while or something, but he this old bloke, sort of straight looking dude, sort of glasses, older guy with beer gut sort of thing, you know, he's sort of looking out for us kind of thing. And next minute we had a gig, and it was like next fucking week, we only had about 8-9 songs that we'd learned, 10 songs I think at the most. And he said, right, you're doing Checkers, New Year's Eve. So it was 1973 to 74, New Year's Eve, and we're doing Checkers, and it was like, fuck, I mean, I'd only ever seen the best bands ever play Checkers, and it was like, it was a big deal for me. I sort of went, oh shit, we're playing at Checkers, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. I was really excited. And I remember saying to the guys, well, we've only got fucking 10 songs. We need 20 songs. And I remember Malcolm saying, oh, we'll make them up. And I thought, yeah, all right, okay, we'll make it up. So we got the Checkers, and I was really excited. It was New Year's Eve, packed to the eyeballs, and Checkers, you know. And so I wrote out the set. There was two sets we had to do. I wrote out the first set with five songs that we knew, and the second set with five songs we knew. Then we had to come up with another, I don't know, three or four songs set. And Malcolm said, well, look, you just make up some titles. And what I'll do is I'll get out there and I'll just start off a riff and a beat and with a key. And he said, right. And then once that's established, the band just comes in and you sing them, Dave. And so that's our first gig at Checkers. I remember the songs we knew were fine, and I'd think something like Rockin' at Midnight or something. You know, I'd just write down Rockin' at Midnight. And I'd say to, and I, before we went on, and he'd say, oh, was that me? And all right. And another one like, you know, you've broken my heart or whatever it was. I'd write that down and go, we'll do that one in A. That sort of thing. So I had them all down on my chart, you know, my song list. I remember getting up there and saying, Rockin' at Midnight, or, you know, we're going to rock at midnight, or something like that. And Malcolm would just go, it's an E, right? And we go, okay. And Malcolm would start his famous riffs. We'd come, right? And then I just start singing, you know, baby, you know, just sing the lyrics, and then I wait for his change into the chorus. I'd come in, you're rocking at midnight, baby, or something like that. So we just did that for half the night. We just made up songs. And at the end of the night, and we killed it anyway. The first gig, the two little guys playing like champions, we got up there and just blew them away. And they were coming off, and a couple of songs that we made up sounded fucking great. And Malcolm goes, oh, we'll keep that one. I said, yeah, okay, we'll keep that one. Do you remember the lyrics? I said, no, I still remember the chorus, so I quickly wrote my choruses. And that's how some of the songs started, from just making them up as we went along. Mm. And so that was our first gig. And we were playing, you know, around Checkers and a few of the other gigs, and we did a gig around Maroubra way. I think Maroubra's surf club or some bloody thing, or some school dance might have been in Maroubra. We hadn't had a record or anything like that at that stage, and but we were getting a bit of a following, and we knew we were going to be recording because George Young had sort of said, yep, you know, getting you a record deal with Albert's, because he was working at Albert's, him and Harry Vander were working at Albert's. And so we knew we were going to be doing a record. But in the meantime, we played this Maroubra joint, and we arrived, and on the door, because no one knew us, really, you know. And it was like, you know, tonight, AC/DC. And it was AC with the lightning bolt, DC, on the door. Because before that was just AC, stroke, DC. And I remember saying to Malcolm, fuck, that looks great. Why don't we keep the lightning bolt? And Malcolm was like, yeah, it's great. So that's where the lightning bolt came from some kid who no one knows who he is to this day. Mm. He'd just gone AC/DC and put the lightning bolt in there. Mm. And that's the story of how the lightning bolt came into AC/DC. Some kid that's going to remain anonymous, mm, probably forever, unless he reads this, and goes, that's me, and I want $5,000 million from you guys. So that's how the lightning bolt came from that from that gig, and so we were starting to get pretty good press. The band was, you know, exciting, and everyone was talking about, you know, the little guys in the band, and we really decided. Well, Colin, one night we were playing checkers, and Colin was really out of it. He used to be out of it for quite a bit, and we were doing the first set, remember, and Colin did this big drum roll, right? And just kept going, crash on the floor. And Colin was just out on the floor, out like that. And it was like, fuck, through the song. And Malcolm just had it, he just went, oh, that's it, you know. Yeah. And he sacked him right there in the checkers. And so, well, shit, we're going to play the rest of the gig. So he rang George, his brother, and said, hey, mate, come down and play drums for us. And George could play, and he's a bass player, and he'd play guitar, bass, right. Mm-hmm. So George hot-footed down to checkers and played the rest of the set on Colin's drums, the next set. So three brothers were playing in AC/DC that night, which a lot of people don't realise. George actually played in AC/DC as a drummer for that night. Mm-hmm. And he actually contemplated for a while even joining the band. He thought the band was that good and tossed it up there for a while. About that time, well, we realised we had to get a new drummer, but Larry, I don't know what happened to Larry. Like, one minute Larry was there, the next minute Larry wasn't there. So all of a sudden we didn't have a drummer and a bass player. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm went out and he was scouting around for a bass player and drummer. So he said the best way to get one is just go and see a band that's got a bass player and drummer that's going nowhere and pinching. So next thing I knew, he said, oh, I've got this drummer and bass player from his band and they're joining. And this bloke called Neil Smith, who's up there with the helmet on. Mm-hmm. Noel, I can't remember his last name. And he pieced him from his band and they joined. And we played up at Hampton Court. We didn't have a gig, and we had to work these two guys in. So we stopped doing gigs, and what we did is, Michael went up to look for a pub, didn't have a band. He went up to Hampton Court up across and approached him and said, there's nobody in here. They had a disco playing. And there was about one transvestite Maori dancing, that was about it, the whole place. And he said, look, you've got nobody in here, put the band, I've got a band together, you know. We just wanted a place where we could play these guys in and get tight, you know. And the guy said, he wasn't really interested. And Malcolm said, look, okay, look, we'll do the first night for nothing. You know, if we pull people in and it starts happening, then we'll talk about, you know. The guy thought that was a good deal, we've got a band for nothing. Mm. So we rolled up and started playing. And the next minute, people started coming in. And the place was happening that night, you know. And meantime, we're working in the new bass playing drum. And so the guy said, okay, cool, to play. So we were a resident at Hampton Court for about, I don't know, 6 weeks, I suppose, 4 or 5 weeks or something like that. And because everyone packed it out and all the sailors were there and, you know, the whole cross-section of the cross were there, you know. So the band was tight enough, but I know Malcolm wasn't really happy with the bass playing drummer anyway. I knew he was looking around for somebody else, somebody better. But by this stage, we were thinking about our image, and most of the bands at that time, early 70s, were still sort of hung over from Sunbury and that sort of gig, and most of the bands had really long hair, beards and jeans and t-shirt. You know, that was sort of it, right? Everyone looked the fucking same, everybody was, you know, was doped out, and it was like, that was the sort of scene, and we were fresh, we were happening, we were young, we were fucking, the the Young Turks, the next lot, you know, ready to fucking go out there and give it to them. You know, we were playing Chuck Berry and fucking getting into it. So we wanted an image that was that would just be absolutely so different that people were going to go, fuck, who are these people, you know? Mm-hmm. And Jesus, they play this music. So we all sort of sat down and thought about an image for the band that was going to just catch everybody's eye straight away. And they'd have to look at you and listen to you. They're either going to fucking laugh us off the stage, or they're going to go, these guys can play, you know? So we all thought down what images we were going to do, and we thought, you know, something crazy, you know? This would be for Skyworks. Yeah. So Angus came up with the idea of a schoolboy's uniform, because he's only 5 foot, and he's, you know, he's a young guy. He passed 14, you know, in short pants, and we thought, that's brilliant. Are you really going to do it? He said, yep. And at the time, there was sort of a few, Slade was sort of happening at the time from overseas. And they were sort of bright, happy band, and Rod Stewart. So I sort of decided to sort of go across between Slade and Rod Stewart, and I sort of got myself a pair of sort of platforms, which nobody was wearing in Australia at that time. It's a pre-Rabbit days. That's where I got the boots from for Rabbit, from AC/DC. And I got a pair of boots made and sort of wore sort of pretty bright pop star-y sort of stuff like Stewart would wear, like a red and white striped jacket, really. And sort of, so it was a cross between sort of Slade and Rod Stewart. Malcolm wanted to look like an airman, so he sort of got lace-up boots and a sort of a jumpsuit. And one of the guys had a crash helmet on and looked like, and Jodhpurs looked like a big cop, right? And the other guy sort of had a sort of clown outfit on, sort of with a top hat. So we thought, well, fuck, you know, they're gonna notice us when we walk out on stage, you know? Mm. And there was a gig that was on at the swimming pool there at Victoria Park next to the Broadway there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There was a gig, an open air gig, and on top of the swimming pool, change rooms and that, on the roof there, and there was a big hill sweeping up to the university. It was open air gig. There was us and another band called Flake playing. And this lineup of Flake was sort of like the end of, Flake had a couple of records out and they had this sort of an image, but this Flake was like the last of a change of Flake, and they were playing in the jeans and t-shirt, and you know, they weren't the Flake that had made the records. But anyway, we said, right, we're going to test out this new gear. So we all got this stuff made, and we thought, they're going to fucking flip and we walk out. And so we changed into our new gear and just walked out on the roof. And the whole crowd, you go, fuck, look at that, you know. Schoolboy uniforms, short pants and bright. I mean, it just looked like, who the fuck are these guys, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we just fucking bang, we into it, you know. And they fucking loved it. But it was really fucking good rock and roll, mm-hmm. You know, with lots of energy. And the boys could play. So we really impressed the crowd. They all clapped. Oh, yeah, he loved it. So I thought, well, that's good, you know. And then Flake played after us. And then Malcolm spoke to the bass player and drummer from Flake. Fucking stole them. And said, hey, we've, you know, got a record coming out. And actually the record that, this is going back a bit now, just before Colin Burgess fell off the fucking stool, mm-hmm. Right, we actually had recorded the single at that time. And that was Can I Sit Next to You Girl, with Rocking in the Parlor as a B-side, and Colin Burgess played drums on it. And I think Larry played bass, but I think George Young came in and sort of wiped the other bass, and George played the bass on the record. But Colin actually played the drums. And when he got the sack, the record was, still hadn't come out yet. And the other two boys we had in the interim were hoping to be in the band when the record came out, but they got the sack when we pinched these two guys from Flake. And they were just lucky that they were, in the sense that they were in the right place at the right time, because when we did the film clip, Rob Bailey and Peter Clack, when we pinched from Flake, were in the film clip.
Mm-hmm.
So they're immortalised in the film clip, but they never played on the record.
Mm-hmm.
So when the record came out, the only three guys that were in the band that played on the record were myself, Angus and Malcolm. So the record got released and started charting down in Tassie and South Australia and West Australia, in a short space of time, it was really good, it was great. And so we, with it taking off down there, there was a tour organised because Stevie Wright just released Hard Road with Evie,
mm-hmm.
part 1, 2 and 3, and they were with Alberts too. And that was happening, that was number one everywhere. We were top 10 at that time down south. And so we had a big concert here at Sydney Opera House. It was a free concert. 2SM, I think, organised it. And nobody knew if anybody was going to turn up, It was like... And it was packed. The whole place was packed. And there's about, 5,000 people outside, 6,000 people or something, couldn't get in. It was just absolutely jam-packed. And so we kicked off the tour by doing the Opera House here, maybe at Festival Hall or something. So I went down to Melbourne to link up. It was us, Stevie Wright, and we linked up with Lou Reed down in Melbourne. And we did a concert in Festival Hall in Melbourne. And to do concerts with Lou Reed, and also to do concerts in Festival Hall Adelaide with Lou Reed. And went down there, and we hadn't got airplay in Melbourne at that stage, so people didn't know who we were, but they were expecting Lou Reed to come out and be like happening, really happening, because he was supposed to be like mate of David Bowie's and all that sort of stuff, and mm-hmm. David Bowie was writing to all that sort of flamboyance in the theatre, and they expected Lou Reed to be as well. And they got a surprise in a sense, because we come on, they hadn't heard of us, mm-hmm. And they just went, and all these, I can see them now, they all had all this glitter on their face and all sort of weird capes on and all this, they were all really happy, mm-hmm. And we came out, with the schoolboy uniforms and fucking stuff I had, and